Blog Talk Radio.
It's a state of mind, and you know, in to me, and yet it doesn't take away from anything else, any other thing or practice, except silliness. it doesn't stop it from happening. It doesn't arrest your development. You know, it can still be as thoughtless as any man can be. We all have the potential for doing that, and we can be as opinionated as our upbringing. Instead of processing, you know, instead of reacting to facts and information going on around us, we simply declare in our mind, this is the way I am, this is the way it is, and I'll go about my business, thank you very much. And I'll call that happiness. Well, it's all fine, except it doesn't, life and the human mind doesn't quite work that way. There's a quote that's been with me for a while. It takes a great deal of courage to stand up to your enemies, and even more to stand up to your friends. And I think, you know, if I look at that metaphorically and I think about, you know, what's friendly on different levels, if all I've known is, here's a predictor that has proven somewhat true and somewhat not. As most predictors, it's an anecdote. You know, lovely anecdotes are lovely because they're always sort of true. You know, this is what I did. I used to be a star, so you should listen to me. except it doesn't quite accomplish the truth. You know, it's just impressionistic. We have a opportunity around us, and these impressions, if all I've known, if I've been raised a particular way, the popular thinking is that's the way I will act. You know, that's the way I will be. And yet here we have this body that challenges that, and it really is saying to the world, a boy can be brought up in certain conditions, and yet he will inherently have a sense of value, of purpose, of agency. He will know right from wrong. And we will be able to build and work on that premise. His faith might be quite discourteous and aggressive, and yet he can, if he can make choices to embrace his fellows, he can embrace mankind and not be fearful of different races and different religions, but can learn to live according to this abstract notion of universality, or this notion of equality, lofty goal, but it's grim. Yeah, at a certain point. When you realize, how old were you when you realized that there were certain complications and situations in life that didn't have an answer, didn't have an achievable answer, let's put it that way, or didn't have an achievable answer that I could live with, or that a good person could live, a reasonable person could live with, a decent person would live with. It depends who's calling the shots and who's saying. There's that public and the private notion that what we say may be for public consumption, and a lot of it is, but it doesn't necessarily reflect what we're saying internally. That smile, that Cheshire smile, that notion of deceit. We can read and we can study, and we should be informed, I think. And instead of mocking the classroom, let's expand. I think I've heard foolish people mock it, and I've heard frightened people mock the classrooms, but I've also heard a very thoughtful people with little or no education, but they're rare, who are observant, and they've found this complete notion that the world, that existence is the classroom. That over there I can go and meet people who have studied a particular subject and have informed opinion. And I like their company because that's an exchange of ideas, and I can learn. And hopefully I will be able to do that for somebody else. So it's pay it forward, so to speak. You absorb, and I absorb, and then we pass that learning on to somebody else. But then along the way, of course, if you're prone to preaching, then you know that you'll be preaching to an empty room. And you'll be making yourself quite complete in your own mind. You're a success in your own mind, but the room itself will be empty. And anybody who has the misfortune of being in the room with you will have learned how to sleep with their eyes open. I can sit in a lecture hall and be captured. It's like sitting in a theater and being completely captured by a singer, just, you know, or a symphony, or walk through an art gallery and do that. But I can't you also find the same cutting across a field and seeing new calves in the spring, or the sheep that are lambing, and knowing that there's new sounds out there. There's a sweetness in the air after everything erupts, awakens from this slumber under the snow. As soon as the limit, somebody limits, you know, anybody limits, puts limits on this kind of thinking. It's telling us more about them than it is about the universe and the world that we live in. What brings it? What matters is, I think, what the person themselves feels they deserve. Oh, I have my loveliest old friend who now, I think, we're getting up to being friends for close to 70 years. Yeah, that's a long, long time. And so we can bounce off of each other. There's no secret. It's chemistry. You know, you have that sense of tolerance and like being with each other. The risk, of course, is that we drop back into the patterns that we had when we were boys, but that doesn't happen nearly as much because we're older, wiser, we have more experiences, and our conversations are much more in depth and enriched. You'll see when you get there. The sense of being able to satisfy yourself, having command, and is like taking responsibility for your own learning. If I'm going to, and I think of it, and maybe I'm romanticizing, but you know, I always have these memories of stumbling along, running along with my little legs, following this great towering grandfather out in the fields with my little rubber boots in the morning dew. Must have been, when would that be? Oh, early in the morning, after bringing the cattle in for milking, and then walking out to the woods and him listening to him talk to himself and teach me that you can set to your work, and there is work that has to be done, not whether you like it or not. So you can be grumpy about it and be dissatisfied with, you know, as if every obligation and duty is somehow an intrusion on your very being. I find those folks tedious and very, very unhappy, very, very dissatisfied kind of people. No matter what they tell me, you know, they're successful in every way, but they just act so dissatisfied and bleak. But you could also set about, and this is grandfather teaching little grandson, you can ask, if you've got to dig a post hole, you can lament it and make it worse and grumble about it and huff and puff and do it quite reluctantly, which in a sense creates more of a burden, doesn't it? You're not only setting to your work, but you've made the task harder than it necessarily has to be because that's your style. But conversely, you can set to the work with an ambition to do it promptly, do it efficiently, whatever words that you find are but do it as to a standard that's satisfying for you. And the standard that you want to achieve is that little bit better tomorrow than what you were yesterday. Always that you read the chapter headings, you'll read the summaries, and then you'll set to the work of the conversation of the author, whether it's a technical manual or a novel or a piece of philosophy. You'll set to the work as if it's you're engaging in conversation with these people. And lo and behold, if you want to understand or you want to meet these people, you can. You meet these people and their ideas and share their enthusiasm through written work, through learning the experience, through biography, through the histories of different people around. If And if you are looking for inspiration, imagine that's the mindset. These events are going on around us all the time. And yet with a mindset, I'm going to extract the essence of enthusiasm, the things that make life a little easier, a little more, that bring a little more contentment, that attempt satisfaction. For a fool that isn't always sure what satisfaction is, the dig the post hole to the best, to the depth that you need, to the shape that you need, you're thinking, oh my goodness, OCD, let's hair bursting into flames. Not at all. OCD is over there. OCD is helpful for particular functions. And if you're a professional and you need to perform at a high level, consistently, you know that OCD is something that you embrace. It's not OCD, oh my goodness, let's get some treatment for that. It's like OCD, thank you very much. I can stand on my feet for 8 and 10 hours and I can stay focused. You do it. You have those little glimmers of OCD. What you think about, I'm not going to make you be, nobody's going to make you, like, grow up. Nobody, you, this is you. You're on your own. You know what cards you were dealt in life, and you know, oh my goodness, yes, the human tragedy. We never get the cards that we deserve. But pay attention here. Everybody goes through the complications. Everybody. It's not a matter of birth order. If only I was born a prince, I wouldn't be having these kind of struggles. Well, don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself. You're making it up. Everybody, there's no escape. There's no escape. There's no escape from sorrow. There's no escape from shame and embarrassment. There's no shame, no escape from loathing. There's no escape from effort. If you want to achieve things, you put out. And if you are a person, if you're looking to be all that you can be, you want to be a person with some that appeals, that people want to be around. Well, or it's like wanting to be in your own company. You create that kind of mindset, because as you're chattering away all the time, you're the one that hears it all. Oh, this hole is so terrible. It's too hot. I hate this shovel. I hate this job. This is meaningless. I'm not going to do math because it's meaningless. I'm not going to do botany because it's meaningless. It doesn't give me a buck. I'm not going to read literature. Bronte, what the hell? That never did anything for the world at all. You know, it's a dog eat dog. Get that money. Grab a fistful as fast as you can and as much as you can. Yeah, really? How's that working for you? And then you call that satisfaction? Well, I call that hubris or ugly or silliness or despotism. You keep telling yourself that, but at the bottom, there will be a day when you will admit to you, I don't know, maybe you won't, maybe you can't, you will admit to you that you're making it all up. And that you're hoping, and that you can turn a blind eye to all that suffering that's going on. Stay away from the – good luck with that, you know, absolutely. I'm not going to rain on your parade here. But stay away from any of the literature and information on the Buddha. He's privileged little boy, did well, you know, because daddy said, I don't want this boy to suffer. I want him to stay and inherit everything that there is to inherit. So I'm going to give him every luxury and indulgence I possibly could, so he will never want for anything else. And yet, when he went on his lap year, what did the boy, this pompous, let's not think about recent history, What did he see? He saw suffering. He saw hunger, degradation, human degradation. He had never seen it before. It's easy, you know. We can do it. We can pretend. All those wars that have been going on, some bully oppressing a disadvantaged group. Yeah, well, yeah, of course. He's not going to fight, you know, fair fight. You know, these are guys that think that they make up the rules of war. Well, no, 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 no. You got a big gun, but you don't make up the rules. No. What are you going to do? Either use it or shut up and leave and do the decent thing and stop killing your young men and stop killing our older women. You know, there's no victory in that. Get over yourself. Getting over yourself is a big, 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 big test. So when we begin to realize these states of mind, we find ourselves more in command, more taking responsibility for ourselves and listen to what you say. No, I'm not talking about all those self-help books that give you a list of affirmations. Although, you know, it's true. It's like the Japanese train engineers that in his function at the end to ensure that he has gone through his entire startup routine, he points out the window in the direction that he's going. Don't you? It's so cognitive. It's so, yeah, it's brilliant. It's clever. Well, the mastery here is to remember that you hear yourself all the time. You are the one. You hear if you're thinking it's a hole, but it's bigger and I'll get through this and I'll do it if I do it as efficiently as I can, then I can move on to other things. And I'm already moving on to other things. And yeah, it's a hot day, but I'm ready for it. I have a bottle of water over there. Let's have at it. Anyway, that's enough. You got the idea of the mindset for this show today? Yeah. All right, we're going to – it's a good show. No, it is. I'm reading the poetry of Ogden Nash today, some decent, decent jazz. The commentary, A Culture of Learning, is all about us. Yes, I'm going to bear the spleen and heart and soul of Freemasonry today. Yes, that's a promise. And the music is – to start with something from 1966, a London concert. Apparently, 1966 is now the new old you remember. Yeah, I won't go there. I can remember the 50s, can't you? This is Benny Carter. I can't get started. It's from the concert he did in London. You'll like it. Help. Thank you. You get the idea. Betty Carter, great entertainer. My goodness. So I don't think that masonry was ever intended to be that, genetic analysis is going to tell you and me whether we have a gene deficiency for leukemia or for a particular type of cancer. I think it's wonderful, except nobody really gives me the manual on how to live with that statistical certainty. Do I want to know? Do you want to know tomorrow? Are you really, really sure you want to know? You wake up in the morning and think, oh, well, today I'm going to try and avoid a thrombosis, you know? I'm going to wake up and avoid breaking a hip or saying something completely stupid, like eclipsing my usual level of stupidity. You don't wake up with that. You don't wake up with it. This sort of Masonic theme, sort of the work. Is very, very gradual. Very, very gradual, boys. Yeah, you can be enthusiastic about it too, but a culture of learning. Let me try and explain this to myself. This is some ruminations here, and you can look over my shoulder as I go through this. Once upon a time, there were immigrants with relatively common roots. Our language, our religion, our work ethic, governance, the structure of our communities, all aspects were heavily influenced. Across a huge landscape, speaking about us here, our new pioneering communities took the names of our homelands, too many to list. And so not to forget, we were in a new land. We appropriated language of First Nations, some. Kanata, Ottawa, Turon are a few popular versions that blended with Kingston and London and Cambridge and Oxford. People crossed a fierce ocean for opportunity. And I say fierce because it is still uncompromising. Don't kid yourself. People crossed it for opportunity or out of sheer, let's just say opportunity is necessity. You needed to be here because over there was crap. And of course, brought with them the values and cultures of their home. Sociologists who've taken up this phenomenon observed that those who left tend to rigidly adhere to a snapshot in time, the time when they left. As if adapting to what's going on around is a sense of disloyalty. It's also a big settling, though, to realize that you're leaving because of some level of oppression and then wanting to be part of remembering the language, the values, the smells of the kitchen, the foods that were, and the tunes, the ways of your old culture, but without the encumbrances. It's that sorting about what I am and what's my who I am. Well, meanwhile, back at home, you're not really part of our group. You know, you're adapting. You're somehow lesser, except two generations later. You know, well, we want to implant who we were and make sure that there's some of the best parts are implanted on our children. But do we ever really figure out what's better and best? We tend to use what's familiar. Meanwhile, back at home, change and progress continues. We have that snapshot, but back there, the places that we left, they don't freeze in time because you and I left the shores. Come on. No, life goes on. And they're doing the same thing we're doing. As always, the different opportunities present themselves, and there's a sense of the selection, the choices we make are always toward the best, better than what it was. And then we can say, well, being that way is the best, and keeping away from some of this change is better. So we do that too. Meanwhile, back at home, things did change uninterrupted. Today, racial tensions being what they are, in a struggle for equality, we see concern for cultural appropriation, which through a Masonic lens seems paradoxical. We know when our feet are planted, but we also strive to be connected with a very unusual culture that has made inroads in most countries around the world. Eventually, old cultures stabilize and take on idiosyncrasies. Eventually, at the start, we have an advantage of willing cultural exchange within the closed culture of Freemasonry. At the start, we know it takes resources in large numbers and sustain to achieve the heights epitomized by symbols of great European cathedrals and castles. That's awesome. And we know adapting old culture is well served when we have an in-depth understanding of what we're doing. Adapting the old culture. We may disagree, but I don't think it is reasonable to suggest that this will be uncomplicated. It's the nature of the beast. It's the nature of us. Life is not a script. And emerging cultures, like being a new parent, doesn't come with a manual. We can prepare only up to a limit, and then we wing it, usually with what is available. We have setbacks, and we prevail. Trial and error. Scientific method. It's happening all around us right now. But then again, it's always been happening all around us. What are we learning? What are we learning? Clark Terry. Everything's mellow. Thank you. breathtaking. Clark Terry. Check it out. It's on his album, Everything's Mellow. Just sweet, sweet, sweet. I wanted to share with you the poetry today of somebody I don't think we've ever covered on the show before, Ogden Nash. Ogden Nash, yeah. He was an interesting guy. He was considered one of the, I don't know if this is any accolade, the most commercially successful English language poet of the 20th century. Yeah. So, you know what I'm thinking about this, eh? But he's American born. 1902 he was born. So he was eyes wide open at the First World War, wasn't he? He's from North Carolina. And his family's traced its roots back to the American Revolutionary era in Nashville and, you know, the honors to ancestors, that type of thing. And he held a variety of jobs. He worked on Wall Street as a bond salesman, but he only sold one bond to his godmother and instead spent his afternoons at movie theaters. You know? All right, we got this guy. He's a school teacher for a year, and then he was hired as an advertising copywriter for streetcar signs. But in 1925, he's hired in the marketing department at Doubleday Publishing, and did well enough that he moved on to its editorial department as a manuscript reader. That's where things started to get really, really interesting. Nash said that it was a poor quality of the manuscripts that he read that led him to try to write. He attempted to produce serious verse in the style of 18th century romantic poets, but soon gave it up. Well, there's a big shock. He preferred to scribble comic verse in pages that he crumpled and tossed across the office to the desks of coworkers. And this led Nash and his friend Joseph Algar to work together to produce a children's book in 1925. It's called The Cricket of Caradore. But a few years later, Nash teamed with Doubleday coworkers to produce Born in a Beer Garden, or She Tropes to Conquer, which made fun of classic literature. But in 1930, he wrote a poem called Spring Comes to Murray Hill and submitted it to The New Yorker, one of the most respected, well-read magazines of the day. And Nash had thought up the poem while gazing out his office window and thinking about his life. And The New Yorker published the poem and invited Nash to submit more. And his regular appearances in the magazine led to a contract for his first work, Hard Lines, that was published in 1931. It was a tremendous success, going into 7 printings in the first year alone. And Nash soon quit his Doubleday job. So during the 30s and 40s, his poems continued to appear in many magazines and published collections, and he was praised as one of America's great humorists. He found great success with his ability to express disbelief and dismay at the problems of modern American life. And he criticized religious preaching and pompous having to do with showing self-importance, pompous senators, and presented amusing quirks, that kind of guy. And later on, he was elected to both the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the National Institute of Arts and Letters. In the 50s, he wrote more frequently for the children's market, like The Boy Who Laughed at Santa, Custard the Dragon, Girls Are Silly. And he died in May 19, 1971. Here, see what you think of this guy. It's a breathy kind of a thing. And I'll cut to the music without saying a word after you hear this. This is a portrait of an artist as a prematurely old man. It is common knowledge to every schoolboy and even every bachelor of arts that all sin is divided into two parts. One kind of sin is called a sin of commission, and that is very important. And it is what you are doing when you are doing something you oughtn't. And the other kind of sin is just the opposite and is called a sin of omission. and is equally bad in the eyes of all right-thinking people, from Billy Sunday to Buddha. And it consists of not having done something you shoulda. I might as well give you my opinion of these two kinds of sin, as long as, in a way, against each other, we are pitting them. And that is, don't bother your head about sins of commission, because however sinful, they must at least be fun, or else you wouldn't be committing them. It is the sin of omission, the second kind of sin that lays eggs under your skin, the way you get really painfully bitten. It is by the insurance you haven't taken out and checks you haven't added up, the stubs of and appointments you haven't kept, and the bills you haven't paid and the letters you haven't written. Also about sins of omission, there is one particularly painful lack of beauty, namely, it isn't as though it's been a riotous red-letter day or night every time you neglected to do your duty. You didn't get a wicked forbidden thrill every time you let a policy lapse or forgot to pay a bill. You didn't slap the lads in the tavern on the back and loudly cry, "Wee!" Let's all fail to write just one more letter before we go home, and this round of unwritten letters is on me. No, you never get any fun out of the things you haven't done. And they aren't the things that I do not like to be amid, because the suitable things you didn't do give you a lot more trouble than the unsuitable things you did. The moral is probably better not to sin at all, but if some kind of sin you must be pursuing, well, remember to do it by doing rather than not doing. Portrait of an artist as a prematurely old man. Ogden Nash.
Thank you.
Shoot, wouldn't you like to be in that audience? I was in Copenhagen in 1971. They had Thelonious Monk on piano, Dizzy Gillespie playing trumpet, Kai Winding trombone, Sonny Stitt did the sax, Al McKimmon on bass, and Art Blakey on the drums. Just, who knew? Who knew? I'm going to talk to... toss out this bit about history. This portion is an explanation of the who they were, and the idea here is to talk about them a bit and to try and describe them as if some of those qualities might be present in you and I today. And it is kind of interesting because we're getting into going to be talking about the influence of the Jacobites, where they ended up, the Jacobites. And just so you know, this was a Jacobite is a supporter of the exiled Stuart King, James II, and his descendants. And they came up after the Glorious Revolution. And the movement, the political importance of the movement, it extended from 1688 until at least the 1750s. So that's the backstory that was happening around the, you know, the lodges were going on and men were leaning in. So you can bet. Don't you think that we would be having those conversations? Yeah, of course. And behind closed doors with people that we allegedly could trust. Well, allegedly, you start blabbering on loose lips, you know, get lost. But the Jacobites, especially under William and Anne, could offer a feasible alternative to the crown and the exile court in France and later in Italy. It was often frequented by disgruntled, you know, people, soldiers and politicians that just weren't happy. Of course, you're going to say, well, those guys were better. That's the Jacobites. And the other side of it is there's going to be, you're going to hear an influence. I'm going to mention John de Sauge. And you've heard about him in the early days of Freemasonry, where he left London and went up to Scotland, and he was the firebrand that brought organization to Scottish Freemasonry. Yeah, okay, well, we'll go with that for now. But he was also a lecturer, and he lectured on Newtonian mechanics. Yeah. Now, for those of you who forgot or slept through that part of the lecture, it's based on the application Newtonian mechanics, based on the application of Newton's laws of motion, which assume that the concepts of distance, time, and mass are absolute. So, and classical mechanics is often called Newtonian mechanics because nearly the entire study builds on the work of Isaac Newton. But there are limits. As you're right, there are limits. If we measure the position of infinite precision, the uncertainty of the linear momentum approaches infinity. And on this regime, Newtonian mechanics can no longer be used, and we need quantum mechanics to describe microscopic systems. Well, I know I interrupted you. You were just going to say that. I know. You were thinking that very, very, very safe. Saying this is the guy. This is, you're going to hear this all again when you hear the name and Jacobites. And this is we're talking about a period here in 1731, and we're in The Hague, and we're looking at this as if this is a stereotype, so we can study what the hell is going on and how the hell did we move around. We didn't have one supreme speaker, the brain, and we weren't all sycophants. No, this was somehow it spread, and we're figuring out how did it spread. So we're going off the first official lodge on the continent, which opened in The Hague in 1731. And now official being the key word here. And this lodge included Lord Chesterfield, that one, yeah, the British ambassador, as well as the ubiquitous Newtonian lecturer and liberal churchman Jean Desaulniers. Oh yeah, him again, you know. Was he speaking about Newtonian mechanics? Wasn't he that guy? These were court policemen, Whigs identified with the Hanoverian succession and the Walpolean ministry. What they had in common with Jacobite exiles, even newly converted ones like Lord Wharton in Paris, was their dedication to political causes, however fundamentally different. These were men with political agenda, and in the case of Desaulniers, with cultural ones as well. In public lectures, he transmitted Newtonian mechanics as part of a cultural package that included its application to history, to industry. Excuse me. He self-consciously aimed his lectures at the genteel and leisured, who subscribed to them in numerous Dutch cities. He was also possibly the first person to articulate the relationship among applied mechanics, labor-saving devices, and profit. With this progressive package came a dedication to various Whig aristocrats and the Hanoverian cause, as well as a fervent commitment to Freemasonry that especially included an eagerness to initiate men of high birth into the order. On the continent, attraction to this particular society with these political and cultural associations implied an openness to mixing with men of different religions, probably an interest in new science, and in a Dutch context, possibly a certain discontent with local magistrates or regents. They were seen to be pro-French and anti-Orangist, or at best neutral to the alliance between Britain and the Low Countries, which after 1714 included the Austrians and the maintenance, at no small expense, of the barrier fortresses intended to protect the Low Countries from French invasion. At the first official lodge meeting on the continent to be recognized by the Grand Lodge in 1731 at The Hague, Francis, Duke of Lorraine, royal representative of the Austrian Habsburgs, was initiated. At the same year, he was supposedly introduced to Masonry at the home of Walpole, Hutton Hall. Ever since the revolution of 1688-89 and the crowning of the Dutch stadtholder, William of Orange, British interests on the continent saw the Low Countries as critical. To preserve this interest, various agents and spies had represented one ministry or another with members of the Whig Party, particularly drawn from its radical and deeply anti-French fringe, often recruited or self-appointed to the task of preserving and strengthening the alliance. One such unofficial envoy was the English free thinker of Republican inclination, John Tolan. More about John next time. Well, that wraps us up for today. Thank you very much for sitting in with us. You know, when we listen to this, we need to be aware that I think there is some sense that by talking about these highborn and high-minded people from our past, that somehow we're going to redefine ourselves in that, as if we are now associating, rubbing shoulders with celebrity, and therefore it will encourage greatness in us. But I don't know that that's the true nature of masonry. I don't know. And it probably does affect some men that way, that if I tell you that I was part of an organization that the Prince of Wales was part of, well, somehow that is an enhancement, that I was selected. And I think that there is some merit in that, but it's not conclusive. It's not conclusive because life has gone on, and the things that would bring positive attention in those days are suspect these days, because these guys were operating without the transparency. The transparency, we don't have to declare it. It's already with us. The kind of communication we have today, very, very hard to maintain a sense of privacy, isn't it? Because we just have to turn things off, including our mouth. How do we even keep a secret anymore? And what secret do we keep? And you know, if you're around healthy-minded people, what's the nature? There's some things that are private and personal, and that will always be the case. So we don't need to be developing a sense of guilt in people because they feel that they have a private life, and that extends to people whose privacy includes the fact that they had a, you know, back in the day when they were heavily influenced by adults, childhood, they went into early adulthood really messed up with strange values, and they learned they didn't have a guide or a mentor or anybody that cared. They learned from the school of hard knocks, and they were intelligent enough. And it's, I think, a reflection of some aspects of a society that intelligent kids can actually find a pathway to success. Now, for those men to want and maintain their privacy, I say good on you. Good on you, and good on you for your accomplishment. That was the past, and that was yesterday. Now, I'm not talking here, I'm not cleansing criminal activity and stuff like that. No, don't get me wrong. You know me better than that. I'm talking about people looking forward. And I'm looking very, very clearly at the systems that produce demons. You know, we don't try and correct problems. We demonize them. But we're getting around, you know, we're seeing we're liking a lot of Scandinavian influences here, thank goodness, and we're being a hellishly effective influence on some parts of the world that just don't like us. You know, they're coming after us, all this social democracy kind of stuff. But those kind of notions are in the background, in the minds of us as we make selections that will determine the future of Freemasonry. So, thank you for sitting in. And if we border on an erudite conversation here, I don't apologize for that. It's like, this is my opportunity to connect with guys like you and men and women like you. And I look forward to doing it again, but not every day. Like, let's take a little bit of a break. And so if we've given you some pause and to reflect, I hope that it's positive. I hope that it's positive, and I hope that sincerely that you can find those pathways for yourself within Freemasonry, knowing that there's other people that have been there before you who have realized that, you know, the false confidence of celebrity and things like that. Here, we're real deal, and glad of it. I'll leave you off here with Joe Turner, Milt Jackson, and Roy Eldridge. And thank you very much for sitting in. Amazing, amazing. We still have listeners, man. We have listeners from Turkey and Latvia. I'm just in Ireland. I'm just got Germany and the Netherlands, the States, and Australia. Australia, you know, I'm quite chuffed. And, the Netherlands, just if I missed your country, I'll apologize because I'll sit in with us and we'll get back to this soon. Thanks for coming. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, by the way.
Oh.